we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM. And we should have on the line with us, if it worked out, Mike Whitney. Let's see. Mike, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Okay, excellent. Well, Mike, as you know, is the economics writer for Counterpunch and a number of other publications. He's been someone who's been speaking about the economic crisis. He's been forecasting elements of it since at least as far back as 2006, and his estimates have been consistently more accurate than those in the mainstream media for certain. We've had him on the program before to talk about these issues. We're very pleased to have him today. So, Mike, thanks very much for coming on the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Brendan.
Well, you know, I've been reading your articles as they come, and I noticed around September you started up again the big machine, the big steamroller, because now there's been like five or six articles from you on Counterpunch and Global Research, Information Clearinghouse, and other places that I like to frequent on the Internet. And certainly you're there to provide a counterpoint to some of the talking heads who are talking but not necessarily analyzing. I know that you're digging deep and just looking into what the data actually says and where things have been going, looking at the flow of money, the change in the economy, and the direction of things, the general direction, and that's somewhere where you've been particularly accurate. Now, I know that the media right now is all abuzz about a recovery. You know, apparently a lot of economic data can be explained by this recovery, but you seem to think that the recovery is temporary or something else. So how do you interpret the green shoots and this talk of recovery?
Well, first of all, I'd like to defend myself. This isn't a charge that you've made, but I think people see some of us who are on the critical side of what's happening, green shoots or otherwise, as being doomsayers and, you know, apocalyptic, like, you know, Mark Farber, always on the bearish side. That's not the case at all. We have extraordinary market conditions where there's essentially no recovery apart from the recoveries we're seeing from the Fed's liquidity program, its quantitative easing program, which is monetization, and also from the extraordinary $787 billion worth of fiscal stimulus. I think there's consensus that even with people who are very bullish on the market, that the reason we're going to see positive GDP in the next two quarters is because the fiscal stimulus and lending programs are having a dramatic effect. The government spending has taken over for the lack of consumer spending and the private spending. And there's really nothing more to it than that. I mean, I'm not a professional gloomster. The situation with the banks is very opaque. But we know that there's still at least a couple trillion dollars worth of toxic assets. And as you are aware of, the $700 billion TARP program ultimately never purchased even $1 worth of toxic assets. They were used to buy stock in the companies and to avail themselves of the capital markets by boosting their stocks, and that's where we're at. But these accounts are still in deep trouble. So as far as the green shoots, I just don't see it. Again, I'm not particularly a gold bug. I think gold is eventually going to fall again as the deflationary pressures really reappear, because people are anticipating that the Federal Reserve is going to be able to weaken the dollar. I'll tell you, there's nothing that Ben Bernanke would like more than to see the dollar drop about 10 or 15% right now, because that would lower the true cost of the financial sector and household debt. That would improve exports, and it would also force more economic activity in the United States, because people would be buying the same things to maintain the same standard of living with money that was worth less. So it's a win-win-win situation for the Federal Reserve, unless, and this is a definite unless the dollar were to crash altogether. And I don't think that's likely, because keep in mind that the G7 and the European, Japanese, and United States banking systems operate as a de facto cartel. And even last week, you may remember after the Robert Fisk story, 2 days afterwards, the Philippines, Taiwan, Thailand, and South Korea initiated a currency intervention into the markets to keep the dollar from plummeting. So these export-led countries are not about to see the dollar fall through the floor. So I think people can feel some degree of confidence about that. It's not as simple as we have a free market and there's no government intervening. The spending is primarily government now, and they're not going to let the whole system blow up.
Indeed. About people that were investing on the assumption that there was a free market in operation, you know, betting against certain things, and then the Fed comes in and intervenes in the housing market, in the stock market, how does that affect people who were making financial decisions based on the assumption of a free market?
You know, that's very disappointing. I mean, I've been on the short end of a lot of investments, and the fact of the matter is that it's always irksome to know that you're essentially betting against the deep pockets of the Federal Reserve. I think we know by now that most people accept the fact that the liquidity programs, the buybacks of U.S. Treasuries, mortgage-backed securities, have not only had a profound effect on the housing market, whatever small blips in sales and prices we've seen in the last 2 to 5 months. Keep in mind, the Treasury or the Federal Reserve has already dumped over $1 trillion into real estate. Just to digress for a second, take us off topic, wouldn't you expect to at least see a 2 to 5% increase in sales if that was the case, if they're putting that much paper into the market? Of course. And the same thing is true with, I think the Federal Reserve made a conscious decision that they realized that the amount of mortgage-backed securities and the garbage debt that was on the bank's balance sheets was too much for the TARP, the $700 billion. So I think that they sat back and figured, well, the only way we're going to get out of this is if we build up the reserves in the banks and allow them to either keep their reserves with the Fed, where they're paid a healthy interest rate as well, and allow the banks to speculate in the capital markets. And this is what's happened, is you've seen this 60% increase in the S&P 500, while at the same time, what's happened? I mean, there's like been 5 million job losses. The credit, consumer credit is shrinking dramatically. Business credit is shrinking dramatically. Basically, the real economy, the broader economy, is doing a swan dive, and the stock market keeps surging. So I don't think one has to be a gloomster to say that there's something basically wrong with this picture, and what's wrong with it is the meddling hand of government.
You know, you've brought up some interesting points, and on the gloom issue, I just wanted to say, certainly I wouldn't say that you're a gloomster. I'd say you're more of a realist, because you keep identifying the major issues that are at stake that perhaps people don't want to talk about, and you often propose solutions as to what could be done to stabilize the economy and promote economic growth. So certainly I think you're taking, you know, a harsh but fair perspective towards the economy. You're not one of the people that consistently portends doom for the economy, and for the most part, I think you're trying to mobilize support for positive changes in the economy. And I guess what we're getting so far is, you know, the green shoots, this recovery is largely government-backed. It's because of government intervention, and it only affects certain sectors in finance, the stock market, and so forth. So in terms of the rest of the economy, it looks like we're looking at some underlying structural problems, because I think you've mentioned that the toxic assets are still there with the banks and the mortgages, and consumers aren't borrowing. They either don't want to or they're not able to. In fact, how's it working for people that want to borrow money so that they can keep up the level of spending that they're accustomed to?
Well, there's three things involved. The first thing is the banks aren't lending unless you are an exceptionally creditworthy customer, and that means collateral, 15-20% down, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the banks in the housing thing, you hear about people getting loans, 30-year fixed under 5%, which is just extraordinary. But the big banks aren't lending the money. 80% of the dough is coming from the government. The big banks, their only function is as loan originators now, and they're just passing on the paper to Uncle Sam. And so it's a wonder. We were basically hoodwinked or duped by Henry Paulson. You remember the provision of the TARP was, we're going to lend you guys this money because you are the credit conduit to the rest of the economy. And we are lending it with the proviso that you lend it to consumers and businesses. They had no intention of lending it. They've kept it in reserves at the Federal Reserve or betting on speculative bets in the equities market. They haven't been lending money. The lending is shrinking dramatically at the big banks. So we were duped into believing that. But I kind of lost my train of thought there. Could you?
Well, I'm just thinking, there's talk about lending, and you listen to the news, you hear about credit and banks and bailouts and so forth. So it looks like one of the major solutions that keeps being put forward is credit expansion. If we had more bubbles and if we had more credit available to people, it would stimulate demand and thus rescue the economy. So why do you think Wall Street favors the credit expansion and the bubbles?
Well, I think you're veering into the ideological, and I think it's really important that we see where the ideological and the structural cross over. And to me, where that crossover happens is in the area of there's only two ways you can grow the economy. Either, especially an economy that's 70% dependent on consumer spending, either you have to see some sort of wage growth and job growth, or the only other money flowing into the economy is going to come from people expanding their lines of credit. And when, you know, since salaries and wages have basically hit a wall and stagnated for the last 20 years, the only way that, you know, the people, the masters of the universe, I think, have figured that we could grow the economy is by relaxing standards for lending money, having all these Mickey Mouse arms and subprime loans and, you know, these pick-a-pays and these piggybacks and all these goofball loans, the bankers, if they ever felt they were liable for the losses themselves, would never, you know, never risk it, but they just thought they could pass the paper off to Wall Street. So the whole plan was to basically make loans more lax so they could expand the credit bubble. And why I say that's ideological is because, you know, if you have a 30-year period where the top 10%, the top 5%, the top 1% keep getting a larger and larger percent of the income, a larger and larger percent of the national wealth, then you know that consumer spending is going to decline because the pie is being sliced in favor of those people at the top. So where are the other people going to get the wherewithal to build up consumer spending? The only way is credit. And now the credit mechanism has frozen, so there's no way to grow the economy. So who steps in? Uncle Sam to cover. But there is an illusion that the customer or the consumer is going to bounce back. And I've read so many reports about this, and you know, it's just not going to happen. It's not. Credit lines are going to be, according to Meredith Whitney, are probably going to be cut back between $1.5 to $2 trillion in the next 2 years. You know, people are not going to be able to draw equity out of their house, which meant $500 to $600 billion a year that was flowing into the economy. Even the current account deficit, which produced between $700 to $800 billion a year, which allowed us to spend more than we were producing, that's going in reverse as well. So where is the money going to come from? It's just, you know, we're going to be bouncing along the bottom for a very long time. And the government, I think for the next decade, is going to have to be involved in various stimulus-type programs, whether it's, you know, through the back door the way the Fed likes to do it, or whether it's voted on in Congress, which seems to be getting more unpopular all the time.
Now, it seems in order to maintain this level of spending, the government in the U.S. is basically printing money. So people have been expecting inflation, talking about the possibility of inflation, but you've been focusing more on deflation right now. So why do you think that deflation is the issue at the current time?
Because the economy was operating off a bubble, okay? So when you expand these huge credit bubbles, when you issue credit, it has the characteristics of money, but it's not money, because when people have to post additional collateral, for example, you go in to borrow money for a bank. You borrow $400,000 in the house, and the bank produces the note, loans you the money. The bank doesn't have the money in the vault, and you don't really get the money. But the money is part of the transaction. But if you don't pay your bills, if you can't meet the requirements or the obligations of that note, then what happens? You know, that credit disappears from the system. But that credit, in some capacity, has already been spent because they raked off the bonus, they raked off the profits, they used it in as far as paying their employees and stuff like that. So this produces an enormous capital hole when everything starts going into reverse and credit starts disappearing from the system. So, you know, the hole, the magnitude of this hole from, you know, what was it like about, all told, there's like $12 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities out there, but, you know, probably only about 3 or 4 trillion of them are going to default, maybe only 3 trillion. But that's a whole lot of money. And the same is true of credit card defaults and all these other things. So whether the Fed is printing money right now, it's not going to, first of all, there's no velocity to it because it's not getting to the people who would spend it the quickest. It's not, the banks are all gummed up, so it's not getting to consumers who can use it and who would spend it. So it's just basically in stagnant pools on the bank's balance sheets.
I see. So that's how you can hold off inflation. You still could have that happening later if the U.S. dollar were to decline rapidly, as was being theorized. You could have inflation based on that kind of currency decline.
I actually think the dollar is going to strengthen. And I think it's an argument that's very easily made. And I think that's why we're seeing, and this is maybe where I seem like a nutcase, I think some of the news stories are actually being affected by official people in the government themselves, because you know they're trying to increase inflation expectations, okay? And the reason they are trying to increase inflation expectations by scaring people about the ultimate value of the dollar is so they start spending money. But the situation we're in right now, where the S&P 500 has gone up 60%. You know, the market is going to correct. And what happens when the market goes down? Typically, the dollar strengthens. Well, if the dollar strengthens, then the real amount of debt in the financial and the household, you know, balance sheet goes up, right? I mean, if you owe a lot of money and the market goes down, but the dollar gets stronger, then in real terms, you owe more money. And that's exactly what the Fed does not want to happen. The Fed does not want to increase the amount of money that people and the financial sector owe, because that creates deflationary pressures.
So
does that make sense?
You'd have to be paying back with bigger dollars.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
I see. So
the Fed wants do we agree about that? Do you see where the Fed wants? Everything the Fed is doing, $11.4 trillion worth of lending facilities and loans and commitments, expanding its balance sheet, everything it's doing is to start some amount of inflation in the system. And it's just had no traction.
And certainly there are some benefits from doing that. But then you're stuck with the basic situation that you've underlined, and that is the government is trying to intervene in a number of ways, and ideologically it favors some ways more than others. So it favors interventions into credit and funding certain things, but not getting those large blocks of spending directly into consumers' hands. That runs counter to ideology. So it looks like we have some barriers to a recovery. You've mentioned the inequality. I think the inequality right now is actually at least as bad or greater than it was during the Great Depression itself. That's one problem.
It is. Yes, it is. It's better. It's worse than it was in 1928. But, you know, let's make one small point about that, how ideological this is. When the government was working out the deal with GM, with General Motors, it was threatening that, you know, you're going to accept this deal or we're going to just disband the union and crush you and everything else. At the same time, it was already working out the deal with GMAC, which is their finance arm. And the deal was already set with GMAC. In other words, it was clear that the government had no intention of letting General Motors fall between the cracks. because they'd already made a deal with their finance arm. So why did they do that? The intention was clear that the government has an hostility towards labor and that they wanted to push it as far as they could to get concessions from United Auto Workers and essentially crush the union, even though they had worked out a deal with the finance arm. I don't know how else someone can explain it, but it does show you the irrational, class-based hostility that people in government typically have.
It's not something you've discussed recently, but it makes me wonder, well, what about the program, the car program that they had, the cash for clunkers stimulus? That put money into consumers' hands, and they were able to purchase new vehicles. Do you think that was effective?
Well, look what happened the next month. I mean, pretty much what everyone predicted is that all you're doing is pushing demand forward so that, you know, of course, people who are already going to buy a car now have an incentive to buy it earlier, so they go and buy it, the government subsidizes it, and next month the industry falls flat on its face, and that's exactly what happened. So I'm skeptical about a lot of these government programs. The only program I think the government could do that would make me happy would be if they actually reduce the cost of the principal on mortgages, which the Congress and the Senate refused to do. If you're serious about that we're dealing with a national emergency, this housing crisis, and now the predictions are in the next 2 to 3 years we'll have 7 million foreclosures. You can't, you know, 7 million foreclosures indicates fraud. There's no business practice that would ever incur those kinds of losses. It indicates fraud. So those people deserve special consideration so the rest of the economy doesn't suffer. So, you know, I mean, the Congress and the Senate have to decide. The judges can be the arbiter to decide whether the price of the mortgage should be pushed down and sliced, the bank take a part of the loss. So what do they call that anyway when they crunch the mortgage? I forget now.
Yeah, I can't remember the term, but certainly I agree. If they can ease the burden on banks and financial institutions, surely they can ease the burden of people that have mortgages as well.
Yeah.
Again, I guess it's that ideological issue you've mentioned. There's huge overarching issues. I mean, there is the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency that allows the United States certain benefits that other countries don't have. But as you say, it's the future is still uncertain as to where that's going to go exactly. In terms of more locally in the United States, you've mentioned a number of the interventions that have been done openly or covertly. Now, one of the ones that you mentioned just before we go, I know Michael Moore's new movie has talked a lot about Goldman Sachs and the other financial firms like AIG and Lehman Brothers, and you were arguing that Lehman's collapse was deliberately engineered. Am I right to understand that this was done to create a basis for the TARP policy?
Yes. It was essentially a very effective way. And, you know, Dean Baker, economist who writes for a number of different publications, he's written about this too, that the timeline pretty much confirms that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, they knew where the problems were. The problems were in the money markets and the commercial paper markets, and they could have initiated a facility that would relieve those tensions. As it happens, they allowed LIBOR and the TED spread and other market indicators of stress in the market to rise and rise and rise till there was a panic situation in the market. And so they could go to Congress and basically stick a gun to their head and say, hey, we want $800 billion. And they achieved that. But keep in mind that it took a full month before the TARP funds were ever paid out and Paulson went to the banks and started handing out $5 and $10 billion bundles of currency. So why is it that the market didn't collapse the next weekend as Paulson promised? Why is it that the market didn't collapse the week later like Paulson predicted? And the reason is that the Federal Reserve, in the beginning of October, initiated the commercial paper lending facility and the guarantees on money markets. And that immediately decreased LIBOR and the TED spread and the other indicators of stress in the market. So was it blackmail? It was blackmail. And what they're counting on is the basic ignorance of Congress to anything that's economic. And there's a few people who are improving now. And the fact that very few people follow this kind of thing. So I think people were hoodwinked. Although, you know, Paulson is coming under a lot of fire now because of his phone calls to Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. What did he call J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs about 19 times during the Lehman Brothers collapse before he even called Obama. So, I mean, I think we can safely say where his loyalties lie.
Yes, there's quite a lot of power concentrated in some of these places, but you've certainly made a strong case for greater financial education for everyone. Thanks so much, Mike. You've given us a lot more detail than we'd ordinarily be able to get, a lot more depth into these issues. So, again, thank you very much. I can recommend our listeners read Mike Whitney on Counterpunch. He's there every week or so. Mike, we can look forward to reading more of your articles on the Internet on Counterpunch and magazines. So thank you very much again.